George Zimmerman murdered Trayvon Martin, a black teenager, on the evening of February 26, 2012, while walking from a convenience store in Sanford, Florida. On July 13, 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Heartbroken and outraged, Alicia Garza took to Facebook, ending her spirited post with, "Our lives matter. Black lives matter." Moments later, according to a June 2015 NPR segment, Patrice Cullors, Garza's friend, transformed the phrase Black Lives Matter into a hashtag, eventually becoming the hashtag of a movement. On this episode of Theology Live, explore with the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson how this hashtag has become his spiritual tagline. I am the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, and this is Theology Live, a contemporary theology series. So we are here tonight at Alchemy in Memphis, Tennessee, with Dr. Andre Johnson. Let's give him a hand. Dr. Johnson, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and what you're doing right now.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the fellowship. Thank you for all of you for coming out and being a part. We know that there are other things that you could be doing right now, but you stop here. And I, for one, am truly grateful and thankful that all of us have come to this place tonight for this critical conversation. And thank you again, Roderick, for the invitation. Well, a little bit about me. I am born and raised right here in Memphis, Tennessee. And went to school here, went off to college, came back. Long story short, accepted a call into ministry. Began to do that type of work, went to seminary, finished, went to the University of Memphis and did a PhD in communication, finished, and all of a sudden now I'm here. And I'm here to do the, I feel a call to both the church and the academy. I feel like not bridging that gap, because I don't think the gap needs to bridge. The bridge is already there. My call, I think, is to help people see the bridge that is already there. And the work that I do as a pastor at Gifts of Life Ministries, the work that I do at University of Memphis and Memphis Theological Seminary, people always ask me, what do you do? What is your research? Here's the one-line research agenda. I study how people talk about the sacred in the public arena. So that leads me to 19th century figures like Henry McNeil Turner. And then I come up to 21st century figures and I'm studying, you know, Kendrick Lamar and hip-hop. Or how folk talk about sacred in the public arena. That leads me to politics. That leads me to theology, because I believe at its core all theology is rhetorical. And of course it leads me to why I think I'm here tonight, Black Lives Matter. And it leads me to that manifestation of what I will talk about a little bit later, the manifestation of the gospel. But that's a little bit about me in a nutshell.
Yeah, Dr. Johnson has quite a following on social media and has been a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement here in West Tennessee. The title of our conversation tonight is Black Lives Matter, a manifestation of the gospel. Why did you choose that title?
Because it is my belief that Black Lives Matter is a manifestation of the gospel. I said last night that I can push that a little bit now, because when I sent you the title, that was, you know, several weeks ago, but I am making the argument now that Black Lives Matter is the gospel. And let me explain why, because everybody like, oh no. In 1968, in Christianity and Black Power,
James Cone. I don't know if you're familiar with Cone, but Cone is the first one to talk about theology's race problem, actually. He's the, quote, father of black theology. But he is the one that talks about theology from an understanding of theology and the language of theology. Since I'm a communications guy, so I'm always looking at the language and how we're talking. He made a survey. He just did a survey of theological language, and it was never any discussion about race. He found that fascinating. So when Black Power Movement begins in the late 60s, he is asking this question. How can the gospel that I just spent all this time studying at Garrett Theological Seminary speak to people who literally having their backs against the wall? Mm-hmm. How can that speak to them, the ones who are marginalized, who are suffering in these, quote, ghettos at the time, in these communities in which poverty was rampant, crime was rampant, and all of that? And he comes to the realization that what he had learned in seminary was not a help at all. Mm-hmm. His sermons were ineffective. His teachings were ineffective because he's a Barth scholar. So, you know, he was trying to bring Barth to the congregation. And it was like, yeah, right, you know, but, you know, what about me eating next week? Right? Mm-hmm. So he begins to look at black power at that time. Mm-hmm. And in Christianity and Black Power, that article, which becomes the impetus for his book, Black Theology and Black Power, in 1969, he makes the argument clear that black power is the gospel. Why? Because black power was talking about love, was talking about inclusion, was talking about the rejection of all kinds of, and I'll just say, caste systems. Mm-hmm. And black power was about the loving of oneself. So he begins to talk about it in that way. And I begin to read that. And I begin to reread it and reread it again and reread it again. And what I have experienced when I go to meetings here, or when I go to protest venues here, or especially when I was spending time in Ferguson, one of the things I was honored to do was to take a class from Memphis Theological Seminary to Ferguson for a week, in which we actually participated, lived with, shared meals with, fellowshiped with, argued with people on the ground and other preachers and teachers and ministers and leaders that were in that movement. I began to feel first this sensation that, wow, this is real community here. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing was radical in so much, not real radical to me, but in so much that everybody around them were saying, hey, wait a minute, you're doing something different here. The inclusion, for instance, the love, the feeding of one's neighbors, the fellowship, this whole Acts 2 type of group, if you will, literally. Just, if you didn't have anything, I was there. If people showed up that didn't have anything to eat, they got fed. You know, this was this inclusion of this community.
And this was being done in the name of religion, or was...
Good point. They were, some of them, in the name of religion, that's what they do. A lot of them were critiquing the church and doing the stuff that the church ought to been doing.
Interesting.
And I just gently reminded them that we have, this is part of our tradition. This is nothing new to, you know, people who have read the New Testament. So you are really, you know, engaged. And one of the things they really loved about us is because we didn't come with any answers. We wanted to listen to the stories, to the narratives. Matter of fact, I'm working on a book, as you know, about this experience. So I'm beginning to understand the gospel. Tracy Blackman, one of the local pastors there. I learned my theology in Ferguson, in the streets of Ferguson. Now, this is a seminary-trained pastor that all of a sudden, I didn't know theology until I showed up in Ferguson and stayed and prayed
with those people. The power of lament, the power of tears and crying, the power of being who you are and being loved and shown love and affection by. So you brought up about the church. The reason why they felt like they could go there and find the love and the compassion that they were looking for is because they didn't think the church was providing that. They didn't think the church was all about that. But again, the gentle reminder that that's the gospel. Mm-hmm. I'm with it. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. Let's fellowship. Let's talk and relate and have a good time around the meal. I mean, and so if that is what Black Lives Matter at its core is, at its core, and I'm talking about knowing the people who are actually working it and getting to know them, listening to their stories, not what we see necessarily on TV and all of that, but the core of it is a community that is banded together because they honestly believe two things. Number one, they're under siege. And number two, they don't care about showing any type of emotion. So anybody who is not, you know, open to raw human emotion, mm-hmm. you know, to see, to have a body out in the street for 4.5 hours and you not be some kind of way. How about that? That's good, isn't it? Some kind of way. It's not human. Something is going to happen later on that's going to blow up, and you need to get that out.
Absolutely.
And so the power of lament, and I can talk more about that, because the power of lament is the power of lament helps us mm-hmm. navigate the pain in our life. To be able to shout and just get stuff off your chest, and to be able to be free to do it without being judged by it. Oh, you just, you know, you crazy, or you just angry all the time. Well, maybe I need to be angry a little bit.
Right.
Right.
And can you say a little bit more for those of us who are unfamiliar, when you're referencing a body being in the street for 4 hours, tell us what that is.
Right, that's Mike Brown. Mike Brown, when he was shot on August 9th, 2014, at about 12:02, right around noontime, that Saturday, his body laid in the street. Now, let me preface street, because this was my shock when I went to Ferguson, right? The street is not Poplar Avenue or not Cooper. The street is the streets that you see in apartment complexes. So real narrow streets. So any and everybody who came outside saw that body just laying there. And nobody picked it up. Nobody cared about the body. Reverend Sekou has a great, great piece where he talks about the deal that Black America's made with America, that you can do this, you can do this, but you just cannot openly disrespect us, right? And that was just a blatant disrespect as far as the community was concerned. I personally believe, and I've said this before publicly, that if the body was taken up in a quick manner, we probably would not have the movement that we have now. Mm-hmm. Ferguson was just almost like a last straw on all the other stuff that had happened up until that point. Mm-hmm. So you got Mike Brown's body 4.5 hours, which made me begin to reflect, it's 4 hours away, it's 4 hours to St. Louis from here. I could have, if I'd known Mike Brown and his family, they could have called me, Mike's dead. I could have gotten in my car, driven to St. Louis, and the body would have still been there. Mm-hmm. That's what brought it home for me. That's actually, people ask me all the time, what made you get in the movement? That's what got me in the movement. That realization right there. And when I began to talk to people and learn all the other stuff that had been happening, that we now know from the investigations and stuff. Remember, when we were going up there, the investigations had not completed. Yeah. People were saying this, and we were just like, oh, when it all came out in the Ferguson report, these guys, they knew what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. They had it to a T. And, you know, so And it does say something. Again, we want to add theology to this mix. What does it mean then to have a theology of the body?
Mm-hmm. And specific, can you, right. and can you, no, spe- I'm sorry to interrupt,
no, no,
go, but can go. You speak specifically having a theology
man.
Of the black body?
Wow. Oh,
specifically.
Man. Well, I mean, it's very hard to talk about the theology of the black body in the context of America. Let's just get real, because we're still, the very fact that you have to say Black Lives Matter denotes that there's a problem with black lives. If you think about that, for why do I even have to say it? Because there are people that don't believe Black Lives Matter. So now I'm adding a theological layer about sacredness, about holiness, about the Imago Dei, about image of God, and about how God has fashioned humankind after God's own self. But if I can't get over that hurdle about blackness first, I can't even get to any of that. So that leads us to a theology of the body of the little girl that was slammed in Columbia, South Carolina yesterday. If you haven't seen the video, it's just horrific, right? So if black bodies don't matter, don't matter. And I can actually feel good about it and think that I have done God a favor because I am doing, quote, my job. Or I am doing what society expects of me to do.
So slaying a black body, slamming, dragging, torturing black bodies can in some way be seen as a directive from God.
Yes, yeah. And you know this, it has been blessed of churches. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, eloquently talks about Americans' heritage. This is a heritage. This has been the MO of America for the invention of America, right? Just slain black bodies, enslaved black bodies, sexualized black bodies, the destruction of black bodies with no kind of regard about image of God, no kind of regard about sacredness, no kind of regard about a theology of the body, right? And if we can't get over that hurdle, I'm sad to say, we can't get to that point, it's going to be very hard to get to a real meaningful dialogue. You got to admit at least that, and I use me as an example since I'm sitting here, that I am profoundly human, which means I can get angry. I don't need to be the big black dude that's mad. I need to be able to get angry to calm down. Right? I need to be able to cry. I need to be able to love. I need to be able to do human stuff. My bad. How about this? Since we theology live. I need to be able to do what Jesus did. Did Jesus cry? Jesus got mad? Did he get a little angry a little bit? Did he get kind of frustrated with those disciples of knucklehead clubs? You know, how are we going to feed 4,000? Lord have mercy. Did we just feed 5,000? God, my God. We ain't got no money, Jesus. I always have that picture of Jesus going, oh, God. And I picked them, didn't I? You know, which goes to show you again that, you know, if you ever made a mistake in life, don't worry about it. Jesus picked those disciples and go, oh, Lord, oh, God. But, yeah, and if we can get to that point, then we might can have a discussion. But it's very hard to get over that hurdle. It's very, very hard. And also, can I add this about the black body? Let's bring in the Charleston 9 for a moment and talk about the expectation of the black body. What do I need to do when I am wrong in order to at least elicit that much sympathy? I must quickly forgive. I must not even go through a process. I must not even look at my slain loved one and think about the loss that I'm having here. I must, when the cameras are on me, I must not get mad. I must smile. I must not yell and scream like I want to. And I must just stand there and just Yes, I must forgive you. I got to forgive you. I wrote a piece on this already, so it's public. That's a bad way to forgive. You're not doing it. Got holistic. Now, if you can do that, great. No problem. Go right ahead. But usually forgiveness is a process. We are all supposed to be on the road to forgiveness. And for a lot of us, it takes some time to even get on the road, depending on what happened. Mm-hmm. And if we're on the road, we're going real slow. Mm-hmm. You know, you there yet? No. You know, and you know if you've really forgiven or not. If somebody walks into this room and they really wrong you and all those feelings start coming back up and you have to do everything in your power to hold on, yeah, you need to go, yeah, just talk to Father. And he, you need some prayer, you know. But no, I mean, again, allowing black bodies to be human is the key. And it's a theology centered around it, and it's grounded in creation. It's grounded in the theology that we already know, but it's just not applicable to black bodies.
So what you're saying is that in this kind of white supremacist theological framework, a white supremacist theological framework does not have room for black people, black bodies to really show any emotion, except kind of this exceptional godlike ability and capacity to forgive.
To forgive, and
the same framework that is leading to black death, basically.
Oh my God! You said it. You said it eloquently, my brother. I thought you were going to go with the exceptional Negro motif, but you can't be too exceptional now, though. That's even tailored, you know. You can be exceptional only to a standard now. Don't go too high, you know. And so that's there. But the framework is white supremacy. We understand that. Mm-hmm. That's the framework. And white supremacy does not have anything. And one of the reasons why some people are taken aback with Black Lives Matter is because within the white supremacy framework, you know and understand what you mean when you say white power or white lives matter. You do mean only white lives matter, but not in Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is just a declaration, that a reminder that we too matter. But in a white supremacy framework, there's no room for the affirmation of black bodies, the loving of black bodies, the caring about black bodies, only, as you say, within a construct that makes white supremacy even feel better about itself.
So you're saying, because it's very popular right now and advantageous for some people to say that Black Lives Matter, the movement, the network, the hashtag, is a divisive hate group, or as one presidential candidate just said, that Black Lives Matter is promoting the killing of police. So you're saying that that's not the case?
No, it's not the case at all. Black Lives Matter have, on a practical level, Black Lives Matter advocates and proponents show up at the funerals of cops who are fallen in the line of duty, who minister to the family of the cops who are fallen in the line of duty, who are there being with, because some of the loved ones are part of the movement of Black Lives Matter, but if their loved one who is a cop is somehow killed in the line of duty, so now they go minister to that family member who still loves their uncle or their aunt or their brother or sister or father or mother or whomever. And Black Lives Matter, the only group and the only ones who are publicly apologizing and publicly offering, rather, condolences, if you will, to slain. Oh, it's never the other way around, hardly ever, never ever, you know? And
as we, and it's a tragedy, it is utter tragedy that 101, I looked it up today, 101 officers have fallen in the line of duty. Most by car accidents, but they in the line of duty.
That's very interesting.
Right.
Very interesting.
101. We up to 980 now, police killing unarmed citizens. 980.
In 2015.
We're going to set a record, I think. So even that comparison, we know Blue Lives Matter, which originates, believe it or not, out of Memphis. That Blue Lives Matter hashtag. We know Blue Lives Matter because my news people tell me so. My media tells me so. I see long processionals. I see blue lights. I see people on the expressway with banners. I see people on the streets. I can't pass TV5 without making a donation in the donation. So I understand that matters. I don't, see the love. And that's what Black Lives Matter is saying, that we don't have the wherewithal to do all the big glamorous stuff, but in Ferguson, for instance, when people have passed on, no matter what, whether it was church or unchurched, street people or not, folk in the movement or closely centered around the movement, these ministers and pastors took them into their churches and they buried them. Why? With dignity and with honor and with respect, because the body is still sacred. Because they're reminiscing Mike Brown did not get that opportunity, at least for 4.5 hours. So they're still doing that. And they're still being part. And that's how they show love to one another and to each other. And for the people who are against BLM movement, that is just anathema. That is just not right. They don't understand that that's still a loved one. And that's still a part, that person had become my sister and my brother. And we are going to feed the family. We're going to have a repair. We're going to feed the family. We are going to take care of the family. We're going to go visit the family. I'm going to stay up with the family. And if I was there, I'd be praying with the family. And that's what those ministers did. Giving, actually, new definition, at least to those people who had rejected the church a long time ago. So a bunch of them that said, forget the church. Giving them a redefinition of the church.
Interesting.
And dare I even say, this is a turning point for the church. This could be the transformation that everybody, in all of your meetings, everybody's talking about, how can we reach out? How can we do? I say embrace Black Lives Matter.
Every 21 hours, a Black person is killed by a law enforcement officer. Which means, by the end of 2015, at least 400 Black people will have died with the sanction of the state, since most of the officers involved will receive a pension, not prison time. More alarming than this, however, is white Christianity's role in undergirding white supremacist social structures. Through centuries of theological justifications for Native American genocide, African enslavement, Jim Crow laws, and housing discrimination, many white Christian traditions have dutifully maintained this nation's racist status quo, actively contributing to the dehumanization of Black people on this continent. With this history in mind, where does white Christianity go from here? Listen in as Dr. Johnson explores these questions in the final segment of our conversation.
So what is your word, your message to the church, particularly white Christians, white Christianity, the white church?
And some Black churches too.
And some Black churches.
Oh my God.
What is your word to them to do theology faithfully?
Yeah.
When a Black person is killed by police every 21 hours. So what is your message to them?
My brother, he coming with the hammer today. Here's what I said last night, and I'm glad I get an opportunity to kind of develop it a little bit further. For my white brothers and sisters, black truth must begin to matter. If it doesn't, we are stuck. There is no moving forward. I don't care who comes and tell you that we can move forward. If you don't believe the testimonies of black people, I can even understand. I made a joke last night. I can even understand. The first time somebody comes to you and say some crazy story about they've been followed or, you know, they think they were racially profiled, you just dismiss it. Then next time. Then the next time. Then it's not this same person. It's another person. They don't even know each other. And then by the 30th time, this is going to have to start to resonate. And that's the only way, because once it begins to get real, then we can begin to start solving them. Because the next step, of course, is, you brought it up, white people need to do white people's work. Mm-hmm. I'm not in those meetings where I don't get invited to some of those meetings. You do, though. And then you can start to say, hey, you know, I used to think like, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. But after the 35th time somebody told me this, there must be something to this. Mm-hmm. Because police brutality has been going on since, like, there have been police. Okay? I mean, that's not an exaggeration. We are about to celebrate the massacre of 1866 right here in Memphis. The 1866 massacre, I'm on the committee. Mm-hmm. And this is when Memphis police officers just devastated black bodies and communities, you know, burning up and all this stuff. This is Rosewood, this is Tulsa race riot. This is all stuff that you know, learn about in history, right? So since the invention of police come out of the old enslaved patrols and stuff like that, right? You know, we know that history. But black people have been saying these stories, though, for the longest period of time. And I suspect that certain white people knew these stories because they knew people within their own families, if they were not police officers themselves, to sit around and talk about this. It's only now that we have phones that we can just record. And let me add this. Let me show you where black bodies, the reason why I say black bodies have to matter and the sacredness about, you know, theology has to matter here, is because even with cameras, even police, you can just say, I'm filming you. Excuse me, filming. It was keep going on. If this was a real attempt at reconciliation, which I have an issue with that word, but yeah, I'll say that for another talk. If this was a real issue of reconciliation, here's what I think people in law enforcement would begin to start saying. You know, maybe that racial bias, implicit bias thing is kind of real. So we're going to just, you know, give an extra second or two before we, you know, jump out the car and shoot Tamir Rice.
Who was 12 years old.
12 years old in Cleveland, right? We're going to actually get out of the car and say, hey, let's see if that's a real gun or two. Let me just one quick second. Would have changed that whole situation. But if I'm already amped to believe that Tamir Rice looked 20, remember that was a testimony, right? We have a suspect here, he's down, he's looking 20. So when 12-year-olds can look 20, I mean, you know, that's a whole nother, a whole nother thing too. But if we can't do that, then it's going to be very hard. Because we still got people debating about whether the little girl that was slammed was even bad. I mean, well, let's see what happened, you know, before the tape was rolling. That makes sense. Let's do that then, right? So give me a reason why the little girl should have been slammed like that. Just one. And if you can't think of one in a hypothetical situation, why are you going to hypotheticalize? Hey, that's a new word. That situation, when you know in your own that if that was your kid, we would have had to come with a whole lot of prayer cloths, with a whole lot of oil, and a whole lot of say, oh, hold back. That would have been, for some of you,
it wouldn't have been school today. You would still have been there, shutting it down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, black truth matters. It has to. All black people are not lying when they say these type of stories, this testimony. You have an opportunity, maybe in your church and your fellowship or whatever, to really be enriched and to really be blessed by these stories that you probably didn't grow up hearing. That you know. And I do understand, because the other part, and I'll be quiet, but the other part of this is that it's hard. It's hard to break the narrative of what America should stand for. Mm-hmm. It's hard to really know the ugly underbelly, the truth. I mean, who wouldn't want this nation to be all that we claim it to be? We're going to go into a political season. We're going to hear how great America really is. Okay. But greatness, or perceived greatness, or whatever you want to look at it, should not eliminate its faults. And if you cannot honestly talk about the faults of, going back, let's talk theology again, or love, or a person that you are in a relationship with, baby, I love you, but if you can't do that, then what kind of relationship do you have? And for black Americans, of course, it has been a tenuous relationship with America at best. Mm-hmm.
As we wrap up, can you tell us how the Black Lives Matter movement, yeah, as a manifestation of the gospel, yeah, has enhanced your own faith?
It has strengthened the faith. It has really strengthened my faith. I said last night, it is my devotional. I love reading the narratives of people who are part of the movement, the good stuff as well as the bad stuff. That's my devotion. What it has done for me is to reexamine my whole theological outlook. I am working on a piece that's centering Black Lives Matter, this theological piece of Black Lives Matter, grounded in the work, the faith, and the tradition of Jesus. And it has just really strengthened me to do the work that I'm doing. So I go to Ferguson, I'm out here on the street corner. If you follow me on Facebook and Twitter, you see the blog, Rhetoric, Race, and Religion, and just trying to bring those voices to the forefront. So we can really begin, if we are serious about it, so we can really begin to have the dialogue. But we got to be able to get over those hurdles. Black bodies must matter and black truth must matter. If it doesn't, we'll never get, I will only come to the table only so far, because my truth will never be affirmed. And some of you know how you feel when your own truth is not affirmed. Just by friends, relatives, neighbors, right? When your own truth is not affirmed, you just don't feel right. And you don't feel like you are really authentically part of in any relationship, or especially the relationship that is trying to be forged around the table. So that's what it's done for me.
Well, thank you for sharing, Dr. Johnson. We are so glad to have you. It was an honor to have this conversation with you. I look forward to it continuing.
Please do. I look forward to it as well. And thank you for inviting me. It has been an honor and a privilege. And you know what? I am better because I've been in your presence.
Stop. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
On August 10th, 2014, the day after Michael Brown's murder and abandonment on Canfield Drive in Ferguson, Missouri, by Officer Darren Wilson, new life was breathed into Garza and Color's hashtag. Brown's blood, scattered on the cement of injustice, broke through the surface, galvanizing a new manifestation of centuries-old claims of black dignity and sacredness. Acknowledging that Black Lives Matter to God causes us to delight in the other, whomever that might be, forcing us to see that, as Roman Catholic theologian James Allison says, God calls us by name, not by category. Because at the end of the day, we are the accumulation of our experiences, the synchronization of our sufferings. And our names begin to symbolize something rich, varied, conflicted, and complex. And when people deny that richness, variation, conflict, and complexity within us, they flatten us, silence us, hegemonize us. They are lying. So yes, Black lives, Black stories, Black experiences, Black truths matter, full stop. And this is not just true. This is gospel truth. Tune in to next month's Theology Live when our guest, the Reverend Catherine Bush, will be discussing literature and theology. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. Our Theology Live logo was designed by Andy Gill. We offer special thanks to our friends at Alchemy Memphis and our guest, Dr. Andre Johnson, whom you can follow on Twitter as @AEJohnsonPhD. He blogs at rhetoricraceandreligion.blogspot.com. Check out 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter @901theology for updates about our live events.